Charlie Wilson is the focus of the book we were just discussing, Charlie Wilson's War, about the CIA's covert funding of the Afghan Mujahideen and their battle against the invading Soviet army in the 1980s. At the time, Wilson was a Democratic congressman from Texas. He took on the Mujahideen's cause as his own and became one of the leading figures behind their covert funding. After serving 24 years in Congress, Wilson is now a lobbyist for Pakistan. I asked him why he felt so strongly about the Afghan cause.
I was outraged, of course, Christmas of 1979 when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan for no reason other than simple aggression. And I thought that, well, this will just be another case of 6 weeks, and they'll pacify the country and kill all the fighters, and it'll just be another satellite. But after several months, it began to dawn on me that the Afghans, without weapons, were killing Russian officers in Kabul with knives and stones and anything they could get their hands on. And then it became clear to me, and I think this is the most important single part of this war, it became clear to me that the Afghans had made a decision themselves, without American or any Western participation, but they had made a decision themselves to fight till the end if they had to fight with their bare hands. And I just strongly felt that people that brave, that were that opposed to being subdued by the evil empire, if you will, that we would be damned by history if we let them fight with their hands. And so that my interest was aroused there. And after another few months, I made a trip just to see for myself as much as I could see along the border there. I had been friendly with Pakistan before this. And when I visited the hospitals and saw the children with their feet and hands blown off by the Soviet mines that had been disguised to look like toys and that sort of thing, and I just became radicalized.
Now, at the time, you were living a lifestyle very different from the Afghan Mujahideen. I mean, you were hanging out in casinos, hot tubs, relationships with beauty pageant queens. Is there an example you can think of the most unusual coming together of cultures, your culture and their culture?
Well, let's see. There certainly wasn't an example that had anything to do with alcohol, because I didn't do that in front of them. I suppose the fact that I was single at the time, and I've been traveling to exciting and exotic places, you like to have someone to share it with, and so I suppose the fact that I wasn't married and they saw me with different Western girlfriends was a major shock to them, although they never gave any evidence of it. They didn't lift an eyebrow. There was one, and it's a passage in the book, but as an example, the most fundamentalist of all the fundamentalists, and he's now wanted. He's now wanted as a Islamic terrorist, but his name was Hekmatyar Gulbuddin. And I had, at one point during the war, I knew that we couldn't get quite. This was at the time when the rules were that all the weapons had to be Soviet bloc weapons. And we were short of some AK-47s and RPG-7s, which is an anti-tank rocket. And we were short of those, and I knew that Israel had a large number of them. And so I was proposing that we buy from the Israelis the weapons they'd captured from the Palestinians and other enemies they had, and that we buy from the Israelis and furnish them to the Mujahideen. Well, some of the people in the agency and others in the American Diplomatic Corps said were horrified by that, and they said they'll never accept a weapon from that had anything to do with Israel. So I asked Hikmatyar Gulbuddin, who was the most, as I said, the most radical fundamentalist of all of the Mujahideen leaders, and he had a very interesting reply. He said, "We use weapons that we take from wounded and killed Soviet soldiers. So I don't know why we can't use a weapon that that Allah provides from Israel."
And so is that what you did? You got Israeli weapons that Israelis had gotten from Palestinians and sold those to the Afghans?
Well, we didn't sell anything to the Afghans. We gave it to them.
You gave it to them. Excuse me. Yeah. So that's what you did. Okay.
That's what we did.
There's an expression called blowback to describe the unintended consequences of a war. What surprised you most about the blowback after the Afghan war with the Soviets?
Of course, and I take my full share of the blame, but, and at the time I didn't realize how serious it was, but the United States, once the communist government had fallen, once the Russians had left, we sort of lost interest, the United States and other Western countries. And because of that, we created a vacuum. And Afghans in a vacuum tend to fight each other for power. And there were many of them that had been radicalized on the Islamic side from their war with the godless Soviets. It was largely our responsibility, because we should have stayed there and we should have insisted that they somehow work together. We should have held out a lot of carrots and more or less forced them to work together, or at least not to go to war with one another. And I was surprised by that. The Taliban then, when they really came in and totally filled the vacuum, and many people in Afghanistan supported the Taliban that did not adhere to their religious beliefs or to their philosophy, but simply because they saw them as the first chance to have order in 15 or 18 years, to not have war, I was stunned and totally surprised and felt very badly about it.
Anything you would do differently if you were going about helping to arm the Mujahideen? If you're doing that again?
No.
You do
nothing
it all the
same. I'd do differently.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yep. Now, what I would do differently, profoundly differently, would be to try to prevent, and I don't think one congressman could have done it, but I would have tried to prevent the immense distraction that our country had with the falling of the Berlin Wall, with the freedom in Poland and Czechoslovakia and all the others, where we just completely were distracted from the problems in Afghanistan. I would try to persuade the administration, that was the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration, that was extremely sympathetic to the cause of the Mujahideen, and I would have tried to persuade them to not leave and to maintain an American presence and to do whatever was necessary in the form of a mini Marshall Plan. Not only in our own interest to keep something like the Taliban from gaining control of the country that provided a refuge for Osama bin Laden, but also to say thank you, because these people are the ones that shed the blood that defeated the Red Army for the first time it had left its barracks since 1945. And we owed them a great deal, and in my view, never properly said thank you.
What are some of the things you think the CIA did to try to hide the fact that it was funding the weapons for the Mujahideen, and that it was funding intelligence?
Think,
yeah,
I don't think that the Soviets were ever fooled. They were fooled for the first few years, first maybe till 1983, something like 84. They were fooled by the magnitude. But it was taking us that long to get everything in the pipeline. As the book points out, the Chinese connection, the Egyptian connection, and all the rest. But I think that they knew that, I think they knew that it was a far bigger piece of cake than they had intended to bite off in 84 and 85. And then in 86, when the Stingers started shooting down their high-end helicopters, which were their major and most effective weapon, then they knew it was a fight to the death.
You're lobbying for Pakistan now. What are some of the issues or business interests that you represent?
Well, I don't represent any business interests. I represent the country of Pakistan. And we just, you try to present your client in the best possible light to Congress. You try to not have crippling amendments. You try to defeat sanction legislation or anything that would be damaging to them. And many, many countries have lobbyists, the Greeks, the Turks, the Colombians. Of course, there's an enormous homegrown lobby for Israel in the United States. That's the most powerful. The second most powerful are probably the Indians, the Hindus. Third most powerful are probably the Armenians.
You've been described as, and I think, in fact, you even described yourself as having gone through the world's longest midlife crisis. Do you feel like you're still going through that, do you think?
No, I'm recovered from that.
So how has your life changed since recovering from that?
Well, I have a lovely wife. I live a totally monogamous life. I don't drink whiskey or wine or beer anymore. And so all of my bad habits are gone, Terry. Or all of the habits that other people would judge to be bad, or that some people would judge to be bad.
What's your assessment of how the United States is doing in Afghanistan now? Do you think that the United States is doing enough to help rebuild the country?
I think that the United States is trying and doing a much better job than we did after the last one. I think we're into the road building. I think we're into providing jobs. I think we're into stringing electric wire and some of the things that we do the best. But I really think that this is as best I can tell from the newspapers. I think that we've made a mistake by not pacifying the whole country. As I understand it, we're basically just pacifying Kabul.
What do you mean by pacifying?
Right now, there are still areas in which warlords of different ethnic groups rule different parts of the country.
What do you mean by pacify?
Well, by pacify, I mean maintain law and order. Maintain the rule of law in Kandahar and in Jalalabad and in Herat, not just in Kabul. Without the whole country, the capital is kind of an empty shell.
Are some of the warlords or former warlords in Afghanistan now people who you worked with when they were members of the Mujahideen?
Not that I know of, but some of the people I worked with in the Mujahideen are on the wanted list and are apparently have joined the ranks of the very radical Islamic militant criminal groups. And I say that with great sadness because I really cared for some of them.
Do you feel personally betrayed, or do you feel like you didn't quite get what was happening?
No. I feel like we didn't do enough and that we could have kept those guys on our side.
Mm-hmm. What went through your mind on September 11th when you heard, when you found out that it was Islamic fundamentalists who were behind the attacks?
Well, I was very grievous and devastated, and somehow I knew that I felt very badly about that. I didn't feel conscience-stricken. I just felt sad. Of the cruelty of the attacks and the fanaticism of the attacks, and the fact that they obviously were coming from radical Islamic people who I still felt that we were in great debt to many of, for really driving the nail in the coffin of the evil empire. And then to see them not on our side was a tough nut for me.
Well, Charlie Wilson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You bet.
Charlie Wilson was one of the main figures behind the CIA's covert funding of the Afghan Mujahideen in their war against the invading Soviet Army. He's also the subject of the new book, Charlie Wilson's War, by George Kreil. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from a new CD by composer and pianist Carla Bley. This is O.G. Can You See from her Variations on the National Anthem.